Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight, where Aaron Patrick makes welcome. I think it's the fourth appearance at the Sydney Institute. He's been here on three other occasions. And tonight, talking on a topic which someone's taken away, but it's essentially on his book. Now, I'll introduce Aaron first. He's the Australian Financial Review senior correspondent, covering politics and business. His previous books include Downfall, How the Labor Party Ripped Itself Apart, and Credlin & Co, How the Abbott Government Destroyed Itself. And now this book, The Surprise Party, How the Coalition Went from Chaos to Comeback. And we're selling copies of that tonight. And so, speaking on The Surprise Party and related matters, Aaron Patrick, thank you.
Thanks, Chair. It's great to be back at this Institute for the fourth time, seeing lots of great faces. Thank you, Jared. You're definitely Australia's preeminent conservative political commentator, and it's an honour to be here. And Anne, you're clearly one of Australia's leading political historians, so thank you so much for having me. I must admit, on Friday was a great day for me because I had my first ever mention in Media Watchdog, which wrote that there was no way Angus Taylor could be held accountable for what was said about him in a column, in a profile in Boss magazine, because the fault was all mine. I had made the mistakes, not contrary to what Naomi Wolf claimed. So,
I think I'm being verbal here.
So I was going to wish for many more references in Media Watchdog, but perhaps not. Perhaps one's enough. When I sat down to write The Surprise Party after the election this year, because I got back to work, and the weekend I said to my boss, this was just such an incredible result, I can't go on with my normal life. I need to get it all out of me, because I'd watched this so closely, and I'd watched Bill Shorten for many decades, who I'd been friends with when I was at university, and I just felt a desperate need to try and tell the story as I saw it. And what I'm going to do tonight is talk a little bit about what happened with Malcolm Turnbull and how he was replaced. I know that's been covered by a lot of other books, but I've sort of got my own take on it. And then I'm going to talk a little bit about the election and what I thought happened. And then it'd be great to open for questions. So exactly why Malcolm Turnbull called the first spill is one of the great mysteries of his career, this glittering political career. And he said he wanted to use a surprise to defeat the attack that was coming his way. And I think what we conclude is that he was losing his grasp on reality. The day before the first leadership vote on August 21st, City's Infrastructure Minister Paul Fletcher held a drinks function in his offices in Parliament House. And the Prime Minister turned up and he gave this rambling and narcissistic speech about the terrorists who are out to get him. He didn't try to rally anyone. There was no optimistic vision for the government or a description of how he was going to destroy the Labor Party, the opposition. Turnbull just wanted to talk about Turnbull. And about the only person in the room who seemed convinced of the Turnbull belief in himself was Julia Banks. Because as she left, he called out to him, "We love you, Malcolm." Afterwards, Malcolm Turnbull retreated to his office where he ate beef tacos with Lucy Turnbull and Christopher Pyne. And they sat round on their mobile phones reading Twitter, chortling about what was going on around them, about the leadership challenge. Particularly when Finance Minister Matthias Cormann got mentioned, who they saw as their primary turncoat. Now, you'd normally expect, I think, in the middle of a battle to retain control over a country, that you would be sitting there trying to marshal support instead of reading Twitter. An Ipsos poll at the time found that 62% of Australians did not want Malcolm Turnbull removed. Despite his failure to hold the party together, he remained more popular than Shorten or any other Liberal politician. 29% preferred Julia Bishop, 14% Tony Abbott, 10% Peter Dutton, and an unknown called Scott Morrison scored 8.6% at that time. Some of the commentary from that time hasn't aged so well. I'll read you some quotes. Sensible people know that playing another round of revolving door at the lodge would create as many problems as it solved, unleashing a fresh chapter of angst and internal retribution. The Guardian's Catherine Murphy. Turnbull is down, but he is not out, even if a slow drip-drip of negative polls will continue for the foreseeable future. Michelle Grattan. Changing leaders would be futile. They've played that card. The sad fact is Malcolm is their least worst option. The Herald Sun's James Campbell. So, clearly at the time, you had a sort of institutional belief that the Liberal Party and Coalition were heading into a colossal political mistake. And part of the problem was is that the average voter has a memory of 1 year, and the election was 9 months out. And so the party knew that the public would be bitterly disappointed at the removal of another Prime Minister, and their memories would be fresh of it when they went to the election. Now, I was uncomfortable at the time with a lot of the language used to describe what happened, that transfer of power. It was not a coup d'etat. Coup d'etat was an illegal seizure of power. It was a democratic process. But apart from the specific language, more broadly, it would be portrayed as a morality play in which the king was betrayed by some of his closest allies, including a duplicitous pretender to the throne, Scott Morrison. It was told the event was turned into a great psychodrama. So I argue in the book the criticism of Peter Dutton, who initiated, obviously, Cormann, and Greg Hunt, who ran as Dutton's deputy, was based on a false premise. I reckon that members of Parliament are under no moral, legal, or obligation by convention to support their leader, party leader, under any circumstance. As a matter of political reality, it is a leader's responsibility to secure and maintain the support of his or her MPs. Turnbull lost the support of people who made him PM, and their Liberal MPs, the public did not elect the Prime Minister. And Dutton, Cormann and Hunt reasoned they had an opportunity to enhance their power and careers. They took a chance and lost. And I don't think that makes them bad people. They weren't Judas, they owed Turnbull no personal loyalty, and vice versa. Call this maybe the realist view of politics. So we all know what happened. On the second ballot, Morrison became Prime Minister. And one of the key questions is did Scott Morrison precipitate the vote? Okay. And this scenario was first suggested in the Saturday paper about 3 months afterwards. And it was picked up with enthusiasm by Nikki Savva in her book Plots and Prayers. Now, I've sat down with people who are in the room, sat down with people who are close supporters of Morrison and knew him well, and they say they just don't know. This is still remains a mystery, and I was unable to find any compelling evidence that Morrison lied when he said he had no role initiating the challenge or encouraging or facilitating the challenge. Because if he did, he would have lied to the people. He would have been a hypocrite when he stood up there and embraced Malcolm Turnbull. So it does go, it is important. It's important because it goes to Scott Morrison's integrity. Now, I think we'd all be naive to think that Scott Morrison wasn't looking ahead and preparing for his opportunity, and there's nothing wrong with that. But that's very different. Being prepared to step up is very different to actively undermining a leader who you claim to be supporting. Once he became leader, his job was to unite the party's tribes and lead a fatalistic coalition to an honourable defeat in the 46th general election. Few in his party, politics or politically engaged society believed he could win. And the opposition was so confident it had proposed one of the most detailed plans for government in Australian history from opposition. And what you had here was the great irony of this election, which is the Liberal and coalition leadership dysfunction gave the Labor Party such confidence that it moved back into itself and it created this very ambitious, almost utopic policy platform, that it felt so confident winning power that it decided to give all its constituent groups, inside and outside, what they wanted. And so they overreached. So the Labor Party was essentially, in one sense, seduced by the turmoil in the coalition. Initially, Morrison was ridiculed for trying to ingratiate himself for his folksy behaviour, as though populist politics was beneath a prime minister, a suggestion I found absurd. The national mood was weary, uncertain. Australians were depressed by instability, but there was no sense of national crisis. The economy was growing, unemployment was low, property and share prices were high. Society had proven to be more resilient than its institutions. Now, I want to say something. I want to talk a little bit about Bill Shorten. I've written about Bill in my other books, and particularly in Downfall, and so I sort of won't go into his whole history. But there was one thing that emerged. There was one thing amongst the many things that emerged this election. There was one unusual thing about Shorten, which I think moved people against him. And this may sound strange, but it was the way he ran. So, look, Bill Shorten's a natural debater. He's not a natural athlete, and he's got an unusual gait. And he looked like an awkward man running away from something, not a confident leader striding into the future. And when he sped up, his arms and skinny legs furiously pumped back and forth, while his padded torso remained strangely rigid. And if you watched on the internet, you'd see memes started emerging, poking fun at Bill Shorten for how he was running. And he seemed to enjoy it. Like, he didn't seem to understand how he came across. And he was creating images. He was participating in political theatre. And he didn't seem to have the judgment to realise that it was the wrong physical image to convey. Whereas Scott Morrison knew exactly how to handle himself, in a sense. His use of language, his use of a baseball cap, his outer suburban demeanour worked very well because that's where the swing voters were, and he obviously knew that. Now, the May 3 debate has often been, at the time, was portrayed as a pivotal moment in the campaign, and this is when we had the physical encounter between Shorten and Morrison. And I went back and I looked at it really closely, and I realised if you slow it down, how this scene is portrayed is that Bill Shorten was standing near his lectern and Morrison approached him to make a point. I think it was a point about taxation. And Bill sort of bristled a bit. And then, momentarily, Bill takes a slight step towards Morrison, almost imperceptible, but you can see it. And then he says, "You're a space invader." And he smiles. And then he walks away. Morrison pulls back. And that moment dominated reports about the debate. But what had actually happened? There was something else that happened, which actually was more consequence, which is that Morrison had surrendered time to Shorten. And he said, because this will give you more time to talk about your tax policies. And back in Liberal headquarters, they felt the more time that Shorten spent describing his plans for redistribution, increase in social welfare, the more undecided voters would be conscious of essentially a tax increase. And at the end of the debate, a media monitoring company listed the words. At the end of the campaign, a media monitoring company counted up the number of words both spoken by the men, spoken most by both men. Any idea what they were? Shorten's was labour. Morrison's was labour. And so what had happened was, because of the perception had been created that Labour was going to win, the focus of the whole campaign had shifted to the party which would pretend it's for government, front was for government, but it also had the biggest policies, the most ambitious tax agenda, the policies which were going to affect most people, positive and negative. And so the coalition had essentially created a situation where it was campaigning like an opposition, effectively. Lots been said about the bias of the press and the media, and I went back and listened very closely to the election night broadcast on the ABC, and there was one point where they're interviewing Barnaby Joyce very early on in the night. And at this point, the ABC hasn't really cottoned on to the fact that the coalition are winning, and they're in a state of denial. And Barnaby Joyce is there, and he's crowing about GetUp directing all its resources, many of its resources, into Warringah, which I argue in the book was a great tactical mistake, because removing Tony Abbott from Parliament helped the stability of the Morrison government, made it easier also to fill cabinet. If you listen to it closely, just before Andrew Provan asks Barnaby Joyce a cheeky question, one of the women on the panel whispers, "Tell the truth." I didn't believe that Joyce was a truthful man. 2 weeks before polling day, the Liberal Party knew it wasn't losing. Their polling was actually fairly accurate, and they could see what was happening in Queensland. They knew Western Sydney wasn't moving to Labor, in part because anti-abortion groups had swamped the area in Brisbane, Western Sydney, and other parts around Australia, with leaflets warning that Labor Party was going to increase access to abortion clinics. And this was a story that the media never picked up, never fully comprehended the amount of effort that the anti-abortion movement put in. And it caused Labor candidates in marginal seats like MacArthur in the Blue Mountains, which we have Meredith here is from, she knows very well, caused them enormous grief. Okay, and people were turning up on voting day holding these leaflets with fetuses. People moved. So that really, really hurt them. A week after election day, there was a young political economist called Carmela Chivers, who was working at the Grattan Institute. And she did some quantitative research to see if there was a connection between class and the result. And she was pretty surprised by what her findings were. Comparing voting at 4,500 polling booths with the previous election, she found that the richest 20% of Australians increased their support by the Labor Party by 2%. The bottom 80% swung to the coalition. The largest swing of the coalition was in the second poorest quintile, essentially the lower middle classes. 2.4% shifted to the coalition. So what this means is the poor, the isolated, and little educated were more likely to switch to the coalition than Labor. Only the privileged residents of the inner cities, more likely to switch to the coalition, only the privileged residents of the inner cities moved to Labor. In New South Wales, booths in postcodes with a fewer university degrees swung on average by 10% to the coalition. Anyone living within 10 kilometres of the centre of their capital in the country was more likely to switch to Labor. The more further out they lived from the GPO, the more likely they were to switch to Liberal National Parties. So essentially, what Carmela Chivers found was the top end of town, who Shorten was criticising, were the only ones who moved to him. You know, I've got a lot more I can say, but it's actually pretty hot and sweaty in here, and I know the room's full, so I might just end the speech there, and we can probably just have questions. So thank you very much.
I think the air conditioning may be off, but the spirit's warm as well. So thank you very much for that. And as I said, we've got copies of Aaron's book, which has just come out, available, and I'm sure I'll be happy to sign them after. So we go to questions and discussion, and we've got plenty of time so everyone can be totally relaxed, as I am. You mentioned, thanks for an important analysis, you mentioned where the Morrison government made ground in terms of seats or held on. Queensland, Western Sydney, where they held or won one seat and lost another one in New South Wales, but held the ground. But you haven't mentioned Northern Tasmania. Now, you can see before the election, the Prime Minister was spending a lot of time in Launceston, which is close to three seats, which he was hoping to win, and he won two of them. But again, that fits in with your kind of profile at the end of the kind of the voter, because they would be some of the poorest off socioeconomic places in Australia. So, well, what about Northern Tasmania?
Well, we didn't talk about coal at all, and that was clearly a big part of it too. But Tasmania was one of the most fascinating parts of the whole election, because who knew that Northern Tasmanians bitterly resent Southern Tasmanians? They think they've got all the money. I did not know that. Anne did. She's politically sophisticated. So the Labor
Party... She lived in Launceston.
Right. So she's politically bitter. But the Labor Party thought they had this great policy, which was, we'll subsidise an AFL footy team for Tasmania. Who doesn't love the footy? And we'll also put money into a hotel next to the Museum of New and Old. But the problem was, is everyone in Northern Tasmania thought that was more money going for Hobart, which all those snobs down there had too much money as it was. So they moved. But of course, I won't bring carbon into it, because that'll probably come up anyway.
Yeah, just stay here. Graham. Look, if you've got the microphone, you've got the call. If you don't, you don't.
Thank you. Well done on a fascinating talk and usually book on a great turnaround. Look, two points. Scott Morrison told a number of people privately that they were going to win the election about 6 weeks out, because he said he'd win every seat north of Noosa because of coal. And that was before Bob Brown set out with the caravan. So I was interested in your comments on the importance of that. And secondly, what did you make of the confidence or overconfidence of Labor in putting policies out in relation to dividend imputation and so on, and having Chris Bowen say, well, don't vote for us if you don't like our policy?
Well, thanks, Graham. Thanks a lot for coming along. I've only for 20 years now, and it's lovely to see you here, my humble book. Bob Brown was the greatest vote deliverer to the coalition, you know, outside of Bill Shorten. That convoy was front page news when they hit Brisbane, and we didn't see it down here. And it represented a threat to jobs and economic development. It was a powerful, powerful symbol of what Queenslanders feared. Now, you may say there aren't many coal miners, but there's a whole supply chain. There are families, there are businesses, and people in Queensland were worried about their property values. They were worried if you shut down coal, the Dunny doesn't go ahead. Well, the Dunny was the great symbol of it. And Bill Shorten was caught in this terrible position where he was having to say, I don't support it, but we're not going to actively stop it. And if you look at his language is actually so strange, because he would use a mix of future and present tenses to avoid giving a clear answer as to what his position was. So, and Labor people say, we don't think it's going to go ahead because we don't think it's got the money. And so in Queensland, that was seen as a repudiation of the blue-collar working class. Okay? It was a really powerful sign of how the Labor Party had moved to the left from the times when I was a member, back at university, when we were under Hawke and Keating, and we were much more centrist party. As for Chris Bowen, that's definitely one of my favourite chapters in the book, about how Joe Hockey and Tim Wilson set him up, and they were so convinced, particularly Josh Frydenberg, they were so convinced that dividend imputation or franking credits was a vote winner for them, that they were really worried that Chris Bowen was going to get done over by his own team. And so Josh would actually go into Parliament, ask questions and taunt him and say, the Labor Party's going to roll you on this. To get Chris Bowen to dig in, because the last thing they wanted was Labor to water down the policy. And I thought that was pretty clever, tactical politics.
Thanks very much, Aaron. I look forward to reading your book. Now, you may have finished the book before the Labor Party's own analysis came out. And I'd be interested there. I guess one of the key things that came out of that was much of the strategy hadn't really changed, regardless of whether Turnbull was the leader or whether Scott Morrison was the leader. And I'd be very interested in some of your thoughts on that. Now, one of your comments about class. Now, I don't know the research you mentioned, but I'd be curious if she kind of did a statistical think that overlapped with religion too, and potentially what that touched on. Arguably, is there's a class division on religion as well. But I'd love to hear some of your thoughts there.
Well, I was very pleased to see the Labor Party official analysis completely supported my book, even though they just got out a bit before me. And I would say you make a very important point, which was the whole Labor strategy and the top end of town rhetoric was essentially created to oppose Malcolm Turnbull. And to me, what really brought home Bill Shorten's failure as a leader was his inexplicable decision not to change strategy when his opponent changed. And that was probably the most fascinating thing about the Labor Review, which was the lack of formal structures to make decisions, to make crucial decisions, like what's our core message? You know, does our core message still function with a different opponent? And so when we talk about political leadership or the effects of political leadership on voting, what we're usually talking about is popularity, because it's much easier to see and I assume measure. But what we don't think about as much is decision making. And so I think Bill was mentioned 84 times in the Labor Review. You know, Mark Butler not once, Tadja Plibersek not once, that I can count on. And that may reflect that as a leader of a political organisation, you have a responsibility to make decisions, make internal decisions, okay, about what policies you're taking. So for me, the thing about Shorten is not just people didn't like him, but it's that he was responsible for strategic mistakes.
Hi, Aaron. Now, the coalition lost 55 consecutive news polls leading up to the May election. How did news poll getting it so wrong affect the Labor Party, the media, and possibly undecided voters?
Well, one of the great stuff-ups of this whole bloody country's political system was their obsession with polls that were wrong. You know, polls that didn't show any variance. Polls that gave us probably wrong readings. And they had a terrible effect. They created a misperception amongst everyone, against elite opinion, common opinion. They influenced behaviour, influenced coverage. And we had this bizarre situation, we didn't realise till afterwards, that the news poll was also doing the Labor Party polling. And they even did some polling for Nine Media, the old Fairfax. And I remember so clearly Saturday afternoon sitting around waiting to go out, and apparently the biggest ever exit poll in Australian history came through on the Sydney Morning Herald website. I don't know, 4:30 was it? And it said, oh, yeah, Victoria's swinging to Labor, government's lost Tasmania, big moves in Western Australia. And we were like, oh, well, it's all over. Dude, that was quick. Okay. And so so I think it was really unfortunate what we had with the polling industry, and hopefully it won't happen again.
So there's a question there. Yeah, I'll wait.
Thank you. It seems that the coalition clearly out-campaigned the Labor Party. As you said, their polling was superior, their social media was superior, their strategy was superior. Everything about the campaign was so well done, everything I've read. What did they do that was so right, taking those things into account? And what did the Labor Party do that was so wrong? And finally, Turnbull said that he would have won the election. Himself, if he was leader, he said he had a lot of polling that showed that he would have won. What do you think of that, Colin?
I love that question. I've written about that question. I answered it first. I, I hope you don't mind. Maybe this is annoying. But would anyone put their hand up who thinks Turnbull would have won the election? No one? I agree. Oh, Meredith does.
I think he could have. Yeah.
What? Why is that?
His own comment suggested that he was going to win. So at the time that they did the handover, Colin did suggest that he would have won. He wouldn't have lost Wentworth in the first place. He wouldn't have had to focus resources on Wentworth.
He would have lost Tasmania.
Okay, I just want to clarify this one, because people can't hear I think on the podcast. The suggestion is that Malcolm Turnbull's own polling suggested he would have won, and the other suggestion is he would have won Wentworth.
Right? More easily. Yes.
More easily, because they won at any rate.
I did. Okay. Oh, you wouldn't went with.
All right. Now, don't ask the audience, because I'll reply. Okay.
Not very good at this podcast business. Where this election was won and lost was on the policies. Now, this was a true election with contest of ideas and a sense of who we should be, what our government should be, what role the government should play in our lives, how we should regulate our workplaces, how we should tax ourselves. In many senses, I think this was a profound election and was one of those, I think, really rare moments where all the politics changes, but the government doesn't change. So for me, it was Coalition One because they had policies which tapped into a sense in Australian society that not everything is right, but the government isn't the entire answer.
We'll just go here, and then Susan, then Anne.
I'm in Bentworth, and I was glad to see the end of Turnbull, because I thought he was one of the most hopeless prime ministers we've ever seen. Of course, along came Karen Phillips on that, and she was consigned to the dustbin of history within 8 months, thank goodness. Do you think the short time she was in did a lot of damage to the non-Labour side of politics?
Who, Karen Phillips? Mm. Look, I'm sorry, I just don't know. That I can make up an answer, but it's probably outside my field of expertise. So apologies, I don't have a good answer for you on that.
Aaron, we saw a lot of Morrison and Morrison only during the election campaign. Watching this government now post-election, what do you think that suggested and what are you seeing in terms of the way that he's governing his party?
Do you have something specific in mind?
I guess just, is there a solitary approach? Is there an authoritative approach rather than a... Turnbull made a big deal about running a traditional cabinet government. What are your observations watching him?
Well, first of all, I'm very sorry you have to sit in the hallway. Okay. But it is your fault for turning up late. Pick up one of these prime seats and come 5:30. That's all right. Look, Scott Morrison, he has these populist elements to his governing style. So at the Financial Review, we have been very critical, say, of his drought welfare. He gives the idea that you can be a farmer and live off the government for 40% of your career, we just find absurd. But it plays to Scott Morrison's persona in a way that Malcolm Turnbull never could have done. What amuses me is that, as far as I can tell, the primary criticism of the Morrison government is that it doesn't do anything. But I think they just abolished 5 government departments. You know, things like that don't happen overnight. So I think we should all just give him a year, see what he's doing. He's moving on IR, which is very unexpected. He's moved on Medivac. So to be honest, I know it's a bit of a cop-out, but I think it's too early to judge. But I've also said this about Anthony Albanese. You know, within 3 months of Albanese taking over, probably within a month of Albanese taking over, everyone's saying, well, he's not doing anything. He's not doing enough. He's now sounding his authority. But politics in real life moves much slower than the media would like it to. And so I think we just need to sort of take a step back and give some time before we really judge. Sorry, I know it's a bit of a cop-out. That's really what I think.
I was given in the election by franking credits. The religious vote was driven by religious freedom. Coal mines were driven by coal mines. Essentially, people were encouraged to vote not for the Liberal Party against the Labor Party. You said that the election was won on policies, but many of the Liberal policies essentially were, we're not going to do what Labor's going to do. It was a fairly, in that sense, and I don't mean it was a negative campaign, but it was in that sense it was negative, in that we're not going to do what Labor's going to do. You're safe with us.
You'll be brief.
Is that a sustainable basis for government?
Well, I guess it's an absence of change, which conservatives would say is a sign of classic conservatism. And goes to the point, I think, of whether you regard society as fundamentally in a good place or in need of significant change. So it really just depends on your personal point of view. Obviously, in this situation, society preferred the status quo, but as you have emerging problems, say particularly climate, views may change, okay? So the answer is it may not be sustainable.
Okay, there, then we go down the back.
Aaron, going back to that, whether Turnbull would have won the election, where I see it, it wasn't just policies, it was also personality. I thought the Liberal launch, at that point I thought they were gone for all money. The Liberal launch was so un-Malcolm Turnbull. It was about, here's my family, and they got up and said why they loved their dad. It was sort of real bread and butter, I'm with the ordinary person. And during those by-elections, in the other election, the last election, 16, whatever it was, Turnbull couldn't even go out to the Western Suburbs. He just didn't know what to do. He didn't know how to talk to them. So really, how much has this personality of Morrison had an impact on what people think the Liberals are like?
Well, the Liberals were quite worried when Morrison took over, because he wasn't well known. Even though he'd been a senior minister and treasurer for quite a few years, he was a bit of an enigma to most Australians. And so he had to sort of establish his image quite quickly. And I think he did a pretty good job. And I opened the book with what I regard as the most important Morrison anecdote of the whole election campaign, where he goes down to the Horizon Church in the Sutherland Shire and allows the cameras in. And this is an evangelical church. And look, we've had religious prime ministers before, mostly before World War II. One of our prime ministers conversed with the Pope in 1902 in Latin. And Alfred Deakin used to go to seances. But Morrison's overt religiosity, that's the word, jarred with modern secular Australia. Funny thing is, it didn't jar with the suburbs. And even people who aren't evangelicals respected his belief and his authenticity. And so that for me was so crucial, because having watched Shorten for so many years, I think Shorten struggled to demonstrate his authenticity. He struggled to be regarded as authentic. And the question is why? And you know, I'm probably saying a quiet moment because he's an inauthentic human being. I wrote a book that I thought Bill was at his most real when he thought he was winning. You know, Bill was at his most real when he had power, you know, on the tip of his fingers, and that's when you saw the real Bill come out. Maybe it is. Now, if you're in a political party and you're going to benefit from that, that's great. But if you're the average voter, you know, politics is obviously not about politicians' careers. So I think personality or authenticity played a massive amount in this election.
Question down the back.
Do you think Anthony Albanese will last until the next election as Labor leader? Also, do you have any thoughts?
I'm not so
on who's going next
time. Look, don't you think, given how many people got this election wrong, none of us should be trying to predict the next election? Who got it right? You know, and in terms of Anthony Albanese, well, look, I my view is that Albanese is doing the right thing. He's trying to move the Labor Party to more middle Australia. He's trying to essentially trying to move away from the Guardian set. And I was speaking to a friend who's a federal MP a week ago on the Liberal side, and he was saying, you listen to the language of the Labor caucus, and it's very different to 5-10 years ago, because the language today is much more akin to The Guardian. And he thinks they've all become Guardian readers. And The Guardian's been so effective because it's, you know, essentially a great product, great news, well-produced, well-written, lots of international news, that the Labor Party has been drawn to it. And that's and he thinks that's actually influencing. Now, I don't know if that's true or not. But Albanese, to me, is, you know, he's the authentic working-class man, self-made man, who was prepared to meet business in the middle, and he'll never use old-fashioned phrases like the top end of town. And I remember Bill went out and saw him out in Western Sydney, started a campaign. He said, "I'll give you some advice: never doff your cap to the captains of industry because they're not better than you." And I'm like, "Come on, aren't we a bit beyond this kind of class rhetoric? This is so old-fashioned. Who doffs their cap to anyone? You know, not the tradesmen out there in Penrith." So I'm waffling.
There's a question out here, right. Speak into the microphone.
I just want to pose this with any respect to you, but also to Gerard and Andrew, who you said quite a lot, they're great political historians. In many respects, the election was remarkable. But if you look at it in the broad context of history, I think really what it showed is that Australians will just simply not go to the extreme, be it right or left. And this was an extreme left-wing, relatively speaking, extreme left-wing policy. I mean, this is a country that voted against vetoing the Communist Party in the middle of the Cold War, while the McCarthy's trials running hot. We don't like extremities. And I just like, so in one sense, it was not remarkable. It was just another good example of what the good recruiting. Australia's just utter bullshit.
Okay, so suggestion is it wasn't remarkable.
Can we take that as a comment? Take it as a comment.
But in case people didn't hear it, it was just that Australians don't go to extremes. Right, so you're taking that as a comment. Okay, where are we? Here we are.
Thanks. I like your thoughts on Longman and related to that, the demographic that was brought out in the Daily Telegraph after the election showing a swing to the left in the more affluent electorates like Wentworth and Warringah, and yes. 11% margin went to 17 and Tony was out, but Wentworth came back. And I'm going to suggest to you that the Liberal Party can handle a small swing in those largely fairly safe Liberal electorates, but the Labor Party cannot handle a swing in the marginals, in particular the important electorates like the coal mining electorates, and in particular I'd like to reference here not just Queensland but the Hunter and Joe Fitzgibbon.
Yeah, why don't you take that as a comment too? Because it seems pretty clear. Any other questions?
You should get a co-author of the next book.
We should.
Dimitri.
Hi, Aaron. Thanks for the talk. Mine is a bubble question, if I may. You said you studied with and you were friends with Bill Shorten. Is that still the case? But more to the point, given his subsequent comments about how long he plans to stay in Parliament, do you expect him to be Lazarus with a heart-lung transplant?
Look, Bill and I don't hang out together anymore. And I wrote in the week after the election that that there was talk that Shorten was expressing a desire that he would like to come back. And the people around him said they thought that was a psychological coping mechanism because he had lost something that he'd dedicated his entire life to and had come so close to winning. And to me, Shorten's statement that he will be around for 20 years is a statement of intent that he intends to be a major player in Australian politics. It's impossible to read into another man's mind, but I do make a hint of my views on this in the very last sentence of the book, so you'll have to buy it.
You did allude a little bit to one of the factors that might play in this next term of Parliament, climate, and it's really destroyed leadership of both parties over the last decade, the inability of the federal governments to reach a sort of policy consensus on what to do as a nation. Is Scott Morrison facing that as his greatest challenge, do you think, in the next term, especially given what's been happening in along the eastern seaboard and in other parts of the country, and the smoke haze being worse than most people can remember it? Is that going to impact on the electorate's mind and raise their fears about climate change going forward, do you think? And their desire to see the government do more than what it's done up to now?
There's definitely a sense in the air, literally, that coalition governments will become more assertive in their climate policies. But I think you'll find them carefully calibrated to do as little harm to economic growth as possible. Because at the very moment, despite what's happened this week, the number one problem facing this government is low economic growth.
Okay. Push it down the back.
Push it up to the tops.
Okay, let's go.
If Albanese is successful in bringing the party back to the centre, is that going to create a problem for him with dependency on green preferences?
I don't think it will. No, I think he's great. I think he'll always get the green preferences. I think what will create a problem is with losing primary votes to the Greens in the inner cities. And there's that seat, is it Batman, in Melbourne, which almost fell. Mm-hmm. And what do we do? And I guess, could we ring
it? It's got a different name, but it was Batman.
That's right, it was Batman. It's got a different name.
Yeah. Jed Carney won it, right?
Yeah. So he's got to win in the centre and try not to lose too much out on the left. Yep. Are we exhausted all the questions?
In 2016...
You guys are insatiable.
Insatiable?
They're
very sellable.
I've got an insatiable question for you. In 2016, Labor went to the electorate with a negative gearing policy, won back from the coalition Longman, Lindsay and Dobell on the Central Coast. But it took the same policy to the electorate in 2019, it lost Lindsay and it lost Longman. What was so different in 2019 versus 3 years ago with the same policy?
I think it was prosecution of the argument, awareness of the argument, and Chris Bowen telling everyone, if you don't like the policy, then don't vote for us. I think people took him at his word. And the irony is about that, is that I went back, and in my research, I found out that Chris Bowen had actually used that phrase before, at least once, probably more. And his own team hadn't picked up on it. And so if he had, if the Labor advisors had said to him, hey, stop saying this, he could have avoided the most damaging quote of his entire career, but no one told him to shut up.
Yes, I'm about one third of the way through your book. It's a great book.
Oh, thanks.
You mentioned the polls and you said that they'll get it wrong next time, but I wonder, why did they get it so wrong so consistently this time, and what is the correction for it? The other question I'd ask is, you gave a chapter of your book to Alex Turnbull. Was he so significant in the election?
Well, I didn't give it to him. I wrote it about him. You think it, well, some people have wondered why Alex deserves such prominence. Oh, look, I thought he was one of the most fascinating. He was a fascinating character in the whole election. In a way, Alex was kind of like an avatar for Malcolm Turnbull, who didn't participate in the election. Alex was the real-life Turnbull there. And I wanted to try and find out, was he actually acting as Malcolm's kind of, you know, vehicle? And I, from speaking to people close to the family, I got the sense that he wasn't, that they were actually a little bit disappointed with him. And, of course, Daisy Turnbull, Alex's sister, has been in the Liberal Party a long time, very active in the seat of Wentworth. And her husband, James Brown, also very active, lots of talk that he might want a political career. Their uncle is treasurer of the New South Wales Liberal Party. So, you know, they had a lot of political involvement. So for Alex Turnbull to be going out there advocating people vote for the Labor Party in Wentworth, caused a lot of family angst. Yeah.
There's a question down there. We're getting close to the end. Yep.
I hope that's right. By way of comment, I live in Wentworth, and Malcolm Turnbull had difficulty talking to us So let alone letting him loose in the western suburbs, I think he found it very difficult talking to people outside his immediate circle.
Right.
My next question, Edward, that was a comment. My question is about migration and border protection. How do you see that playing out between the two parties, like in the future?
In the future?
Yeah, as to whether that's going to be a big issue or not.
Well, the irony is this, we've essentially got bipartisan agreement on border protection. And why would you walk away from that if you're the Labor Party? And so it has been a credit to Peter Dutton, who's an interesting character, who's obviously prosecuted this the most. And he has this very right-wing persona. But as far as I can tell, Dutton's actually a bit of an atheist. And his colleagues think he probably voted for same-sex marriage, even though I'm not aware that he's ever disclosed how he voted. And by all accounts, I don't know him, but by all accounts, he's quite a warm man. So you have this interesting person who's out there to who is very, very effectively prosecuted a case for the coalition where, in theory, they don't really have a superior policy because both sides essentially have a similar policy, which is pretty tough. You know, so I guess that's a mark of political tactical success.
It's more than this is about medical evacuation. Right?
Yeah, look, no, sorry, you're absolutely right. They don't agree on medical evacuation, so it's not entirely bipartisan. No, but yes, you're right.
Aaron, I just want to get your observations on three critical events in the election campaign. The first one, Bill Shorten's inability to cost his climate change policy. The second one being his exchange with the Gladstone worker. And the third one being the passing of Bob Hawke 2 days before the election.
Well, they're all great questions and all very thoroughly covered in chapters 9 and 13. I don't completely spoil everything for you. But the Gladstone worker was one definitely worth focusing on because that, to me, summed up how sometimes momentous events can turn on fortune. And a man who was an engineer forgot to bring his lunch to work one day. He was a contractor at the Port of Gladstone, so he heard there was a sausage sizzle on and he turned up and Bill Shorten was there. And this guy worked all around the world. I think he had adult children at university. And he was reasonably well paid. But he happened to be he happened to have a blue collar on. And so on the day, I'm sure, does everyone know the anecdote, what happened?
No.
So he approached Shorten and he said, well, why are you increasing taxes? And the Labor policy was to increase the top marginal tax rate 49%. I think he had to be earning $180,000 to be covered. And Bill Shorten didn't really know what to say, and he said, oh, we're going to have a look at that. And it was a very short encounter, I don't know, maybe 30 seconds. And that was jumped upon because, of course, the Labor Party did not have a policy to consider reducing the top tax rate. It was only to increase it. And so he was seen as being dishonest to this bloke. But this bloke was dubbed a tradie. It was the big tradie confrontation. And in that sense, Shorten, from that perspective, Shorten got a bad rap because that chased him for a month, but at least a month. And Morrison brought it up in the debate we discussed before, and I think that was a very pivotal moment. And still, I saw newspaper clippings a month later calling this bloke a tradie. Okay, but you know, so if he'd been an engineer and he turned up wearing a white shirt and a tie and he said the same thing, you think we would have had the same outcome? Absolutely not. I don't believe it.
Just a final comment. How do you view the Morrison government? It seems to me that it's probably the most united coalition government there's been in since Menzies' time. Or do you see divisions within the coalition?
What division? You think of anything in particular within the Liberal Party?
I mean, do you think that Morrison looks more secure than Abbott did or Turnbull did because they didn't last very long? How do you see it? Or do you think the party's going to rebel again against this leader sometime?
Great question, Jared. I think my sense is that when Morrison was trying to make his way up through the ministry, he used to get mocked because when there'd be a big dinner of MPs in Canberra, and they'd have two dinners, one for the Conservatives and one for the Moderates. And Morrison would go to both. And this was seen as not particularly honourable. And I think in hindsight, to me, it represents his strength in the Liberal Party, because I think we have, the country has, a Prime Minister who's able to straddle both wings of this, of our oldest major political party. And so for that, in that sense, that's why I think he's structurally more secure than Tony Abbott or Malcolm Turnbull. But it all depends on his performance.
Many thanks.
Thank you.
Well, a lot of people here, and we're pretty well right up on time. So firstly, I should say they're copies of Aaron's book, The Surprise Party, How the Coalition Went From Chaos to Comeback, which is a great read, and you would have got us into that tonight. And also tonight we've had an informative, incisive, but also amusing talk, which is a great way to end the year. So many thanks to Aaron Patrick. Well done.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.